Early on in the program, I called out to parents who are probably parents of autistic children or family members who have children who are autistic, because it is World Autism Day on Tuesday, and I'm speaking to the Cambridge youngest university's black professor, Jason Arday, who is only 38 years old, and he was diagnosed with autism as a child and couldn't read or write until he was about 18 years old. Today, his research focuses on improving education for autistic black people, and he was also he's also got connections in South Africa. Professor Arday joins me now on the line from the UK. Professor, very good morning to you, and welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning, Zane. How are you, my friend? Are you well?
I am well, and I reached out this morning to two of my friends who I know who have children, a family member who has, an autistic child, as well as a friend of mine who's a nurse, who also she sent me a message during the course of the week saying, my child has just got his first bank account. He's now 18 years old. And this autistic child was so excited for this bank account, for his independence that he's got. But Professor, welcome. And can we start, first of all, with something basic for you to define to us? Define autism for those people who probably don't know the full extent of autism.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there are several definitions, and I wouldn't want to proclaim to be the font of all knowledge on autism, but I guess a universal definition is that autism is regarded as an intellectual disability which resides across a spectrum. So there's several forms of autism, and more generally, that the common feature in all of those forms of autism, to lessing or varying degrees, is a kind of intellectual, like I said, an intellectual disability, which can affect cognitive development or other aspects of kind of neurodevelopment, generally speaking.
Mm. You only started speaking at the age of 11. What were those years like for you? And do you know what was actually preventing you from speaking?
So that part of it was down to, it was part of the autism, but it was also part of a condition called global development delay, which is a cognitive delay which affects motor skills and cognitive development. So that was the kind of part of it, and obviously the autism part was the part that kind of compromised aspects of, or perceived compromising of my intellectual capabilities. I mean, one thing I would say is that is a misconception, that, you know, autistic people have their intellectual capabilities compromised by autism. I think that very much is situated within the medical model of disability, not the social model of disability. And I think it's really important that people understand that, you know, the social model of disability is situated around can do, and recognizes that disability is viewed in a different way. So, for example, the dis part of the ability is in brackets, and the ability focuses on the individual's ability to overcome, to use the abilities they have, and to be able to define knowledge and intellect in a different way.
Mm. What eventually enabled you to read and write? What was that breakthrough moment for you?
It's a very difficult thing to define. I mean, one of the things with the delay, a developmental delay, is that kind of things will happen when they happen, and there's not really any precursor on when that will happen, or any kind of indication of when that may happen. Obviously, you know, I had thousands of hours of speech therapy and kind of developmental classes around reading and writing, but I think that the biggest part of it is probably more aligned to faith, if I'm being honest, because obviously the experts make a prediction, and my mum kind of tirelessly worked with me to help me and support me. And I think those interventions at some point kind of calcify and crystallize in one's mind. And because of how developmental delays work, it is the delayed aspect. So once it kind of all made sense, I was sort of on my way, but it was hard because you've got a lot of catching up to do to be able to make sense of certain aspects of, you know, how literacy works, you know, in practice, you know, which is not an easy thing to learn when you're 18, because I guess in retrospect, those are things you would learn when you're in your kind of very, very young, the embryonic stages of infancy. You know, we're talking the developmental kind of cycle from 3, 4, 5 onwards. And in my case, I was learning that as an adult. So, you know, the distance, one thing that is probably quite hard to explain to people or for people to comprehend is distance travelled. It's been a remarkable journey.
If you'd like to chat to us, you have a child with autism or you have a family member with autism and you'd like to chat to us about that, you can give us a call on 021-446-0567 or the WhatsApp line on 072-567-1567. Well, Professor Jason Arde chatting to us this morning. Professor, you stand tall today as the youngest black professor at Cambridge. Can you tell us about your efforts then to democratize education?
Yeah, so I mean, look, all of this kind of predates Cambridge. I've worked in higher education for 11 and a half years. So my focus, the focus or the nexus of my work was always focused around, you know, racial inequality in education through many intersecting variables, you know, gender, class, disability, religion, etc., just to name a few intersections. And one of the things that I was really kind of fixated with was how does educational inequality pervade and how does it impact the lives of particularly black, indigenous and ethnic minority people domestically and also internationally. And so that's kind of where that focus came from. And it was really around, right, how do we get a better distribution of resources and how do we democratize, you know, the kind of economic advantages and other forms of economic, social and cultural capital, and how do we democratize that so all individuals, but particularly black and ethnic minority individuals, can have better outcomes in the national education system, so the UK, but then that work extended more broadly to the international kind of spectrum.
The South African context, as well as the African context in terms of, you know, black education, is vastly structured and vastly different and vastly unequal to what it was 20, 30 years ago, because now you have a vast number of people in private schools, you have a vast number of people in private universities, and people can access more things in terms of what they are able to afford. So these days, you know, sometimes it looks like you have to buy an education in South Africa. But how will your research help to improve education for black people with autism? And are you working concretely with any organizations within the African framework?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's kind of really interesting is trying to understand where the kind of inequities lie. And obviously, you know, South Africa has a population of, I think, just over 70 million people, but a very, very small populace, probably less than 7%, would be able to access the private school system in South Africa. And I guess one of the institutions that I've been very fortunate to work with, that I am a visiting professor of, is Nelson Mandela University. And a lot of the work that I've done with this particular research centre, CRISHET, which is a critical centre for kind of racial studies in higher education, really focuses on the resource in South Africa and how it's distributed to those most in need post-apartheid. So those are kind of, you know, for me, that's been a really important body of work over the last 5 or 6 years, which kind of continues to build on the legacy of the democratization of educational resources and really the redistribution of educational resources to those most in need.
Chatting this morning to the youngest black professor at Cambridge University, and we're chatting about autism and his research on autism and how it is specifically geared to the educational as well as resource-based outcomes for for black people in South Africa. Professor, we believe you joined an anti-apartheid protest with your mom, and you have very strong connections in South Africa. Want to tell us about those?
Yeah, no, I was very fortunate. When I was a child, there was a lot of, you know, this we're talking mid-90s. And look, I can't say I was conscious enough to know exactly what was happening. But obviously, I was, as I became older, my mum explained to me what I was doing in those protests with her. And obviously, my mum was kind of anti-apartheid and protesting in the kind of the annals of London, central London, you know, Portcullis House near Parliament, in the South Bank of London as well, and really was part of a collective of young black activists that were really kind of presenting a call to arms in terms of what was happening in South Africa at the time and the debilitating effect it had on South Africans, and really a lot of that was happening, standing in solidarity with kind of campaigners like Winnie Mandela, obviously Nelson Mandela, Christopher Harney, Stephen Biko. So a lot of these things were kind of just few. Were kind of Miriam Makeba. Were really happening as a rearguard action to kind of support what was happening in South Africa, and really to support the cultural boycott as well. So I was very fortunate, obviously, not that I knew when I was, you know, because I was born in 85, so I didn't know this when I was around 7 years old, 6 years old, but you start becoming a bit conscientized, you know, by 95, I guess one of the more seminal things that I remember is the 1995 Rugby World Cup, and its significance in the context of kind of, you know, I know there's a romanticization about Mandiba, but the context around the Rainbow Nation and what that, you know, how symbolic the lifting, you know, Springbok rugby, what it represented for white Afrikaners, but how much it actually, you know, in some respects, that being a, you know, a bridge. For
becomes a sort of a unifying factor.
Yeah, and you know, and I think for black South Africans to be a part of that, and I guess the iconic images of the then South African rugby captain Francois Pienaar lifting the trophy with Nelson Mandela, which has kind of been immortalized and crystallized in history. So that for me, you know, becomes one probably my big first sporting memory. But it also represents something a lot more symbolic, and I guess, you know, those kind of things, that they stay with you because they're bigger moments in sport, but it's able to provide a reference point for my mum's activism around that area and many other people around the UK who were anti-apartheid and were really kind of putting pressure on the UK government to engage in disrupting the atrocities of apartheid, which at the time the UK government were not doing.
Yeah, it is very sad, but it's a wonderful history of our country, and I think we've come out on the other side of that. When we spoke about democratizing education and, you know, specifically getting everything aligned for the education of black people with autism in the country, where do you think that resource and the need should be coming from? Who should spearhead that? Is it private sector? Is it education that needs to spearhead that under the sort of guise of the government? Whose responsibility and whose oversight should that be?
Yeah, it's not that I said the private sector should do it, but I think the private sector has a lot to answer for. But fundamentally, resource, distributed or democratized or otherwise, is always orchestrated by the government in hand or the government in premiership at the time. And I think, you know, Raposa, I think, and colleagues, I think there are ways for them to refocus and focus where those funds should go and to those most in need, because, you know, the reality is they're the custodians of those funds. They're the people that are in charge of where the funding gets distributed to. And I think from an economic standpoint, I think it's really important that there is a focus around how a future or how a people are able to, prosper and to find ways of really providing a balm for that intergenerational scarring, residual scarring that is still a consequence of that apartheid system, because it still affects millions of black South Africans till this very day. So I think that, you know, the incumbent government will always be the people who will orchestrate what happens in society. And I think there needs to be more of a focus around that. And there are obviously a lot of political and economic factors that may implicate that. But I think it should always be at the forefront of anyone's tenure or anyone's premiership in South African government.
A lot of people asking, is there anywhere local organizations or local academics or students can actually read up on your work? And somebody wants to know if there's a book coming, because they heard a little birdie fly that you are actually writing a book.
Yeah, no, a lot of, that's very kind. A lot of my work is available online, so it's readily accessible, and I guess there's hundreds of talks. I've spoken all over the world, and I think most of them have been recorded, so they can be found in kind of YouTube and other kind of social media platforms. I'm not on social media myself, but I am well informed, because people write, you know, I've had over a million people write to me from all over the world in the last year that they've managed to catch some of the things I've said. Yes, I'm currently writing a book called We'll See Things They'll Never See, Love and Neurodiversity, with my colleague Dr. Chantal Lewis at the University of Oxford, and it's really focused around how we provide better spaces for neurodivergent people to thrive in society and within the education system. So that book is coming out next year. It's actually in publication now, it's in the publication process now. And it's coming out in the spring of 2025.
Your message, it is World Autism Day on Tuesday. And I don't think that, society in itself has actually got a grips with autism and what it's all about. And society doesn't really understand it, because I think anything that we don't understand tends to scare us and we tend not to go closer to it. So what would your message be for World Autism Day, please?
My message would be for individuals, globally speaking, to continue to educate themselves around the kind of minutiae and the various kind of multi-context views or perspectives around autism. I think it's important that we don't see this as a static disability. We see it as one that is continuously evolving with how people are able to make sense of their existence. So I think we need to really embrace autistic and neurodivergent thought as a difference that should be accepted, and difference is good. And when people are able to add different ways of thinking, different perspectives, different ways of viewing the world, that is only advantageous to all of our global and societal existence.
Professor Jason Arde chatting to us this morning about his research into autism, and specifically black autism in education. And he is the youngest black professor at Cambridge University.